This is gonna hurt. It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
We all want the next generation to be strong and resilient. Warriors that can fight any battle that may come their way. Being able to take on the world and navigate the twists and turns of life. We provide them with all the resources and tools they may need to stay in the fight. Through resources and training, preparing the mind to take care of itself. We give the tools away, but rarely instruct on how to make those tools. A big part of self-reliance training is not only to provide resources, but show how these resources were created. To give a hand up and not a hand out. Not only giving someone a fish, but teaching them how to fish and helping them make the rod. I'm Kevin Donaldson here with Mike Felice, and welcome to the Suffering Podcast. If you're a fan of overcoming adversity and overcoming suffering, then we're for you, because that's what we do here, and that's the stories that we highlight. So do me a favor. Hit that like button, subscribe to the channel, please comment, ring the bell to get notified of all of our new content, and now you can join. Follow us on all social media so you can find out what we're up to. And on tonight's episode of the Suffering Podcast, we welcome AJ Luna to discuss the suffering of veteran services. AJ has spent a long time serving his country, and he continues to do it after being out of the service. AJ, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Yeah, Kevin told me a lot about you. I was excited to meet you tonight. So,
I work with a friend of his, and he's like, hey, you got to meet this guy. And we had a conversation. We hit it off.
And then once you met him, he said, I really don't want to know this guy.
Any friend of Mike's is an enemy of mine. Not you, the other Mike. Before we get any further, let's give a big shout out to our marquee sponsor. That's Toyota of Hackensack. We don't trust anybody as police, but we do trust them. So go to ToyotaHackensack.com. Let them find you a car. So, AJ, each week we take a question from our audience. This one comes from BDK-74. How do you differentiate between a handout and a hand up? You're our guest tonight. I want to leave this one off to you, and I'm pretty interested about your answer doing what you do right now.
Handout, you give somebody what they need, but there's no room for improvement, no room for empowerment. Hand up, you're trying to get somebody to get themselves to get empowered and to do better for themselves. So be careful with the handouts, but always look for the hand ups.
It's a great answer. Mike, what do you think?
But you know what? I mean, handouts, like you said, it's like a pay it forward type thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we talk about paying it forward all the time. In law enforcement, we didn't like getting handouts.
Oh, some of us did. Yeah,
I'm sure you did. But I mean, to me, the thing, like I said, it's just giving back all the time. You know, hand ups. I mean, I know the concept of it, but I really don't. You know, like I said, like AJ said, teach a man a fish, or
sometimes it's difficult to put into words because you know the difference.
Yeah, exactly, but you don't. That's what I'm trying. That's what I'm trying to do here.
I'm pretty sure you guys saw it on the street all the time, and in social services too, right? You got that person on the corner, you know, asking
for a handout.
For a handout, but there's always a story behind that. And again, depending on the environment, for us, like I could give you the example of what I did at the county. We would really try to get to the bottom of why we're in that situation.
Why are you looking for a handout?
Why are you looking for a handout? Like what's going on that you have to resort to that? And again, there's been some good stories. There's been some bad stories. Unfortunately, some people can't get out of that. But you do the work hoping that you can get as many people as you can out of that. Something as small as maybe person's not getting the right mental health treatment, right? And they don't know what's out there.
But I think it comes down to ability. I really think it comes down to ability. If you have the ability to give, to earn what I'm giving you, whatever it is, you just might not have the capability right now. So if I'm giving you something, whatever I'm handing out, and it gives you the ability to get that for yourself, well, then that's something different. But you have to vet those things very, very carefully. For instance, on social media, everybody gets them on social media. Mm-hmm. The woman comes and she says, oh, I can't feed my kid. And this just happened the other day. I can't feed my kid. And, you know, can you give me some money or buy a painting of mine or something? I said, okay, well, you know, if you can't feed your kid, this was my response to it, because I knew it was a scam.
I can connect you with some social services in your area to get your kids some food if you'd like that. And then she comes back. this is great. Mm-hmm. I'll do anything on camera for you. I'll play with myself. I'll do whatever I got to do. And I just type her back. Wait, I go, don't lower yourself to that.
Yeah, well,
and right now, whoever was behind that message just went, oh, man. But you look at the picture, and her hair was done, her nails were done, her makeup's done. Well, you know, you're spending money on your hair and your nails. That, you know, cut your nails yourself. You know, your kid's more important. So that's a person, that's an example of what I'm talking about. That's a person who has the ability, refuses to use that ability, mm-hmm. but prefers to have somebody just give. And that's like a, you know, I guess she's looking for a sugar daddy, and I'm not that guy.
Well, there's websites for that, but I mean, you know, you're very right on saying you always have to vet the situation. Like, you always got, I got a question. Like, a lot of people have the heart for veterans, right? You go on Facebook, you know, I got the disabled vet. They need this. They need that.
Well, Eddie Murphy proves that in Trading Places.
Yeah.
So he was out there begging for food, and he says he was in Vietnam, and meanwhile his legs are tucked underneath, and when the cops chase him, he just runs away.
It's hysterical when they lifted him up. And his legs came down.
It's a miracle.
But you know, you brought up something that ability, disability, probability.
Okay.
Capability. You know,
capability. Yep. All got ability in there. It's how you want to use that.
Correct.
Right. You want to use a disability to your advantage? Is there a probability that you could do something that you say you can't do?
Well, you could take somebody like our friend AJ Capone, or AJ, sorry, AJ.
JC Capone.
JC Capone was struck with Parkinson's, has a horrible disability, but he turned it into an ability.
Ability, exactly.
And was just featured in the movie Reptile on Netflix.
And you know, there was a little probability that it could turn that turn it into an ability. You know what I'm saying? That's what I'm saying. That word ability, whatever you put before that,
mm-hmm.
probability, yeah. capability.
Yeah, you just don't want to, you got to be careful where you don't want to, you refuse ability.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Well, yeah. Refuse ability.
Abuse ability.
I think that's.
And just not trying, because again, I think for all of us, we understand that, you know, we're always taught to eat those, never give up, right? Always try. So for me, if, you know, you engage with somebody and they don't even want to try, but they don't even want to, you know, try to make an effort on their part. Well, then, you know, it can make it very frustrating, especially like, you know, knowing what I've seen, that just a stroke of luck or a couple of good things that you do consistently can turn it around quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
So BDK, thank you so much for sending that one in. Keep sending in your questions and we will try to get them on the air. So
how do we get a 5-minute conversation out of ability?
Listen, we can sling some
on anything.
We can sling some bullshit in this studio. So AJ, I've done a lot of research where you have vetted us. I have also vetted you. Plus, there's a connection between us with our mutual friend Mike Martin, and I'm very grateful that he introduced me to you. This episode is going to air a little bit after Veterans Day, but I wanted to bring somebody that's tied into the veteran community in here to really give a taste, because you do something that's a little bit different. You don't only talk the talk, you walk the walk. And I think that's something really important for veterans these days, because, hey, listen, most of these, they went out and they fought for the country and they did their service and but not all of them, you know, that's the problem. I think Bill Burr says it. He's got that joke, and he does it at VFW halls. Of course, somebody who's non-military gets offended by it. But it's like he's waiting to get on an airplane, and they're like, okay, any women and children going first, or any people with disabilities, and then it's any veterans. And he's like, he's sitting back there. He's like, what the hell do I got to do to get on the plane? That's all I want to do is get on the plane. This guy, he's probably peeling potatoes. He's not, you know, because they want to honor heroes. And they're like, how do we know he's a hero? Did he ever fight? Did he ever do anything? But he's
stuck in KP duty.
Exactly. So why don't you give our audience a little bit about yourself? Where'd you grow up?
Well, I'm originally from Brooklyn. And
what part? I mean, you got it.
East New York, Astoria City. You know, had a pretty good upbringing. My mom, my dad was a dental technician, first generation American. And
where's your family from?
My mother's from Dominican Republic, and my father's from Argentina.
Wow, that's a wicked mix.
I tell people that you know, my dad loved my mom.
That's like Puerto Rican and Costa Rican.
Exactly, they don't mix.
They don't mix.
Well, I've seen Puerto Rican and Italian. Now, on the there is Italian on the side. The only problem is they didn't come to the States. They just went down to Argentina, and then they came back up.
It depends on what part of Argentina your family's from. Are they from the German sections, the indigenous, or the non-indigenous people of Argentina that just happened to show up there after World War II? You know, are they those? It's like, wow, you're from Argentina, yet you have blonde hair, blue eyes. That's odd.
Mendoza was my father was from Mendoza, so he wasn't from Buenos Aires, which is like the big European, blue eyes, blonde hair, and you know, farmer.
They wear armbands.
Yeah. The whole.
Juan Perón was a wonderful man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
but so they immigrated here, wanting a better life for them, and then you come into the world, but they come into this chaotic city of New York
during the 80s, which
New York wasn't a very favorable place in New York in the 80s.
Well, depending on what section we were in,
yeah,
maybe Brooklyn was a good place for them to move to.
The complex was new by New York standards. Something that was built in the 70s is new, so the neighborhood, you know, when it first started, people were moving there. And, you know, I remember my father always telling me that, you know, it was good when it started, then it started to go through some changes. And then, you know, I mean, you know, you see what's going on now. I'm happy that my family's over here now. My mom's actually pretty close from here. She lives in Wayne. And that happened a couple of years ago. But, you know, we survived. I mean, we did what we needed to do.
It always shocked me. So people immigrate to the U.S. and go in the most expensive city in the world. That it happens all the time.
Well, they don't,
and it's
they
been happening for 100 years.
I could tell you a story. That
they don't immigrate to Podunk.
The problem is that people go, that's where they go. And then you have this melting pot of all these people. And then people, but you know, because sometimes it's so crappy in somebody's country. You know, they don't know that New York's New York. So they go there and it's a lot better than what they had in their former country.
That's probably the only thing they see, you know, like see on TV and even, or hear and about and is New York.
Even that, it's good for some people. I mean, I know for me, what kind of gave me the experience to travel out was joining the military. And I remember that probably a very good thing that I did that just to get that experience, because you think the whole world's like Brooklyn, and that's not true.
Your parents improved their situation. You tried to improve your situation. Mm-hmm. That's the meaning of life, is always try to improve your position.
But sometimes, you know, you catch some breaks. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you don't know. You don't have somebody there that's guiding you. I know that on my family side, mm-hmm. they were very big into religion. So, you know, that was a foundation. But, you know, the same struggles like every other family has. And look, I know that... they probably would have wanted to do more. You know, my mom's still here. My father passed away in 2019. But I think they did the best they could under the circumstances that they had.
Well, being from another country, your parents, did they embrace the U.S. as their new home? Because you see that sometimes. Some immigrants into this country still want to think that they're back.
Here's what I know. When my grandmother, my grandfather came over, and then it was my dad and my uncle, I know how... My grandma always used to tell me like how grateful she was that she was here, and they left Argentina when they were going through like a recession back in the late 70s. They lost their house. It was bad. But she used to say stuff like, listen, if people don't want to eat well here, it's because they're not trying. I mean, are you kidding me? And she was a coupon clipper, right? She was a big thing. And then she would just all this food. And she used to say all the time, she goes, I don't understand how people could live bad here. So, you know, I mean, and it all, she could only have that perspective if shit wasn't bad as bad as it was at home.
Doesn't that come to what we were talking about before with ability?
Yeah.
You get the ability to do anything you want. You know, you have the capability of doing anything you want.
Listen.
You know, you don't have the probability of doing what you want.
No, but.
It's there for you.
Yeah, it's possible. And just the fact that she said that, and again, sometimes people that are here, you know, I don't want to say take for granted, But
all day long.
This is all that they know.
This is all
and
day
again,
long.
You know, you go through an experience and listen, I think, you know, I'm proud. We're very welcoming country. We want people to come here, kick ass, do the right thing, make better lives for themselves. That's what you want. But that can only, you can only have that drive if things, you know, if you experience things that make you think, wow, you know, this is a better way. And sometimes people, you know, they feed into the negativity and all that stuff. And there's negative and positive in life everywhere. But, you know, if this is all you know, and, you know, this is all you've ever known, how could you value it if you don't have a different experience?
But your parents in general, did they instill the being American? You're an American. You're mm-hmm. born here. See, I love that when immigrants come into the country and they embrace the culture and they, like, we're so multicultural here. They embrace America. Like, we're a unit right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy that. But I was wondering that because you chose to join the military. Did you go right out of high school? Did you go to college first?
One semester in college.
And you just decided to go off and...
Well, I had the idea for a while. And at that point in my life... And again, this goes back just reflecting. You know, my parents knew that, you know, in their head... College degree will equal success. We'll get the hell out of Brooklyn. College degree equals success. At that time, I wasn't really ready to really commit myself. And I was an okay student, but I wasn't,
Well, you look at the difference between somebody who's 18, goes off to college, not having any life experience versus, say, somebody in their late 20s who's going back to college because there's a big difference.
It's a huge difference.
Watch how hard they study because all of a sudden they're paying for it.
Yeah. You see some people go to college later in life.
Yeah.
Like you said, they're paying for it. Like you said, I'm in a one semester club myself. You know, I went to college for one semester. Like, I'm done. I was 18 years old. You know, you're away at college.
Well, at that time,
nobody tell me to go to class. Screw this,
Mike. Right. If nobody's really pounding your head, why is it important? At that time, you don't know. You're just thinking about other things, but you know that, you know, you have to do something in order for us to change the trajectory. That I did know, and I think for me, you know, I always had a big thing with the military when I was a teenager.
What drew you to the military?
Just like. I love that commercial, Be All You Can Be, right? I mean, it just seemed like a very good opportunity. And
not so much the Army of One campaign.
And I came from the Be All You Can Be. I mean, Army of One, it's, you know.
Well, the Army of One, but, you know, that was a advertising disaster for the Army.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. Because there's no such thing as an Army of One.
You can't be an Army of One.
Unless you're Mike's Army.
but believe
Hashtag Mike's Army. We haven't brought that up in a while.
Interesting thing here is, you know, because it was East New York, who really spoke to me about it was a gentleman who lived in the building. He joined the Marine Corps. And he was telling me, he said, hey, you know.
November 10th.
Hey.
Marine Corps birthday.
We hear it every time. The memes are already out. But, I mean, those guys, they're hard charges. But this guy Adrian, he really kind of just made me look at it another way. And I said to myself, all right, well, shit, it's a couple of years. You know, what the hell am I doing here?
Right.
You know, like, it's not going to get any better. And believe it or not, we had a lot of people that I grew up with ended up joining the military. You know, and I'm not ashamed to say, but there was no opportunities back then, you know. And then again, you know, I saw my parents bust their ass to pay for me to go to a Catholic school in Brooklyn, Severian, right? And we're struggling. I mean, my last year, I worked at a hardware store just to help pay the tuition. And back then, it was like $5,000. And I'm thinking to myself, holy shit.
What year are we talking about?
99.
Okay, so that's
96 to 99.
Yeah.
And look, I just said to myself, well, wait a minute. Okay, I've been getting fed. Go to school. And I'm like, I'm not ready to really just, you know, do that. Like, I want to kind of get some work experience. And then, you know, like I said, for me, I had positive and negative experiences in the military, but I think generally very positive. I mean, you know, you go through that transformation. You know, you get a steady paycheck. You learn stuff. So I
get some structure,
which was needed.
Yeah.
Which was needed. You get to really, you know, not care about bullshit, and you know, you force yourself to have to work with people.
Well, so when you have, especially going through boot camp. You know, it turns the volume down around all the bullshit in your life.
Yeah.
You know, where, hey, listen, you don't know, you don't have a clean shirt to wear today. Well, this guy over here has got to go run 25 miles with a rucksack on. You know, all of a sudden your unclean shirt,
it's not that big of a deal.
No. You know what? I think we all need those reality checks from time to time.
Puts things in perspective. At the point.
I know that when I went to Basic, I had a lot of people, same thing. Some people were homeless. They were losing an escape. I had another guy, religious guy from Tennessee, told me like, hey, I'm getting three hot meals, man. I'm good. So you hear all this stuff and then you start to say, wow, you know, there's a reason why I'm here and there's a reason why I have to listen to this. Cause sometimes, you know, you take stuff for granted. And I guess for me, you know, like I used to tell people all the time, before the Army, the only island that I went to was Long Island. Other than that, there was nothing else there. That was my worldview.
Staten
Island, yeah. And I went there after I came back. But you start to learn stuff. I think probably the only negative thing was you always had the culture stuff, right? And it's weird because I'm a Giants and a Mets fan. So,
oh, dear Lord.
So somebody, I had a guy from Texas, real big guy, rural guy, you know, call me a Yankee. I didn't know that was a derogatory term. So I turned around and said, no, I actually like the Mets. Thanks for asking. And you just kind of have to deal with it. It's the same thing. Like everybody's, you know, trying to be tough, make it through this. But I think for me, when I came back is when it really, like, things started to come into place.
So the first time you go through your boot camp, first time you come home, what was the, were your parents shocked at your transformation, proud? What was their reaction?
A little bit of both.
Like, wow, look at my boy. He's a man.
Well, it was different. It was very different. I could tell you that when I came back, I told my old man, I said, look, I'm paying you a third of the rent. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to do shit that a 20-year-old does. You'll have your rent. I can help out with food. Like, it was different. Like, and my old man was like, who the hell is this?
Mm-hmm. Well, you did your 2 years and you're out.
No. I joined the National Guard once I got out.
Okay.
So so they gave us that option back then because it was a big thing. Like, I don't know. I didn't know if I was going to like it, but I actually ended up loving it.
Well, people have a misconception with the National Guard. Like Earl Granville, gentleman we had in here, he's National Guard. He's over in Iraq, gets blown up, gets a leg taken off.
Yeah.
You know, so people think National Guard, oh, yeah, you're...
People think National Guard is the easy out.
Yeah.
No, but that's the thing. I could tell you, I got deployed with a guard unit in the city. And when we went and they were trying to get battalions out of there, you saw all the guys that really signed up for the reason they were supposed to sign up. All of a sudden, everybody's got a hardship. You know, everybody's got stuff. So we had a backfill from guys from Buffalo. But listen, I just got out of active duty, ready to go. And I think a lot of people don't know that, you know, this war, Iraq, Afghanistan, a lot of people, their number was coming. They were going to go.
So you signed up before 9/11.
Yes.
Okay. So you were in... Did you get through your active duty in the Army?
Yes.
Before 9/11?
When 9/11 happened, I was in Korea, and we were out in the field. And I remember, because it's like a 13, 14-hour time difference, and I remember our captain, who was from the Bronx, come over and ask us, everybody in the tent, hey, who here lives in New York City? You know, I raised my hand, and I said, hey, so what's going on? And he took me and said, hey, call your family right now. And that's when I found out. We were stuck for an extra week out there, but, you know, I came back probably 5 weeks after and I went to Ground Zero. I remember the smell.
Yeah.
And I knew that, listen, it was only going to be a matter of time. And then by that I figured out, okay, well, it ain't a 2 year commitment. Everybody has to do an 8 year commitment. So let me just, you know, if I'm not going to stay on active duty, I'll come back home and serve in the guard. That's it. But I knew, like, at some point, you know, something was going to pop off.
Right. You knew you were at that point, everybody in the military either really wanted to go for vengeance or just knew that they're going.
Yeah.
They're going in some
they,
form.
They just action. Started strapping up, saying something's going to happen soon.
Yeah, something's going to pop off. Happen gonna... soon. I'll be honest. I'm glad that it didn't disrupt my life as much. And I'll tell you why. Because when we... when I came back, I went back to school. This time I went to Brooklyn College. Went back to St. John's, and they said, oh, yeah, you know, we'll take your GI Bill. You can take out some loans. I said, no, thanks. I'm good. I'll just go to a better option. To me, English is English. Math is math. I get a degree. I go back home, and my NCOIC, my sergeant, called me, like, during a final, December 2023, and all he kept saying was, Oh, get your stuff ready. We're getting
2003.
2003. Yep.
You said 23. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. 2003. Yeah. And he says, "Oh, get ready. We're getting deployed to the Middle East." And I say, "Could you be a little more specific? The Middle East is a pretty big place." But I got to finish with stuff. Yeah. Well, you have to, because I mean, how did you know? Some people
can't say no.
Yeah. Like, oh no, go fuck yourself. I'm not doing it.
Middle East? No, I don't feel like going there.
No, middle what? No. I'm not doing that.
You got anything in like Punta Cana or something?
Yeah.
At least I get some sun. I get some color.
Kev, you'd be surprised that we did that. We got the orders, and I'm telling you, a lot of people like. They skated out, and every reason not to go. Especially the guys that did 20 years, that were up to a 20-year, they were retiring left and right. Oh, no, yeah, I can't go. I already did my time. Yeah, but listen, this is where it really counts.
We need you now.
Yeah.
You know, we need But, you know, those are the people that joined the military, maybe for the not the right reasons, who got out like that.
Look, I look at it like this. Like, one of my old sergeants said to me, you know, you do what you do, you have a good life in there, but you got to do what you got to do. But when you're needed for that moment, you got to go for that moment. That's what you're doing.
Mike, I know you've seen this throughout your career. When the shit hits the fan, there are two types of people. There's those that run away, mm-hmm. and there's those that run towards. America is thankfully more heavily towards the people that run towards the danger. You see it in times of war. You see people stepping up and doing their duty, and they feel very deeply emotionally attached to their country. My country needs me. They're calling me. I'm going. But then you have the other ones who are like, no thanks.
I'm good.
Yeah. It's an unfortunate, but I'm very grateful for those ones who stood up and went.
Well, those are the people that you gotta, you know, you gotta tip your hat off and support, because without those type of people, this whole thing we call, you know, our beautiful country, it doesn't go the way it's supposed to go.
Exactly.
And again, you don't want to, you know, you're always going to have people that don't want to do it, but you want more than less.
Well, I was always wondering when I was 26 during 9/11, and I was always wondering, Mike was 57,
I'm still 57.
You haven't aged a day. So I was always expecting that another draft was going to come in. So I actually started preparing my life and getting my life together, figuring that there was going to be a draft. And I always said, if there is even a hint of a draft, I'm just going to go, because I don't want to be drafted. I want to go willingly. So I got myself ready. Thankfully, it never came. I would have probably been denied anyway. It was during the don't ask, don't tell. So I'm okay. I firebombed your joke.
I was carry on.
So where did you get deployed to?
2004 to 2005. Did about 11 months in Iraq. So I was stationed in a place called Camp Scania, which was 70 miles southeast of Bayat, which was the Baghdad airport. And got to see that whole country.
Then now your perspective on America probably changed the most.
Yeah. No. Listen, here's the thing. It was like a two-form transformation. So the first time I went, I came back from active duty. I came back to the neighborhood, and the neighborhood was different. Right. It wasn't that the neighborhood was different. I was different. I just didn't feel like I fit in. Right. And I came back.
You had a different perspective.
Yeah.
Is what it really comes down to.
And then the guys that I grew up with, like, they're doing the same stuff that they're doing. And I'm thinking, Jesus Christ. Like,
why don't you grow up?
Yeah. Grow up. Like, you guys like living like this?
Yeah.
But listen, that's just me.
That was you 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, two or three years prior. Yeah. Didn't even know. Right. And I'm thinking, oh man, these guys are cool. Like, they get to hang out. No. And then totally like zoned everything out from the neighborhood. Just, hey, I go there to sleep, but I got to go out there, hustle, do what I got to do. I'm fortunate. I've been able to be employed ever since I got the military. I never had that issue. But the second time I came back, that's when I really had an appreciation for this country. And I said to myself, yeah, I don't give a shit what these college students say. There's nothing that you're going to tell me that you've been through is worse than that. And people are dying to get over here.
Well, you watch any protester against the government, okay? You watch any protester, well, just look at what they're wearing. They're usually dressed in expensive jeans, expensive shoes. You know, they don't know what real, they don't know what it's like to live without. And when you go over to those other countries and you see what real people are living without. Yeah. You know, one of the things, whenever I went out of this country, and I didn't go over to the Middle East, but whenever I went out of this country, I always like to drive around into neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Except for in the Dominican Republic, you don't do that.
Oh, we'll go together, don't worry.
Yeah, then it becomes dangerous. But no, I go into these neighborhoods and even Aruba, somewhere as nice as Aruba, they have locals there. I would go into their neighborhoods and just see how people live, because I'm a big person where I need to get my eyes on how somebody lives down here. I'm not talking about the vacation resorts.
Yeah, that's
the
what they present to you.
Yeah,
say, hey,
I want to see this. And you know, in every place there is people are happy, but they don't have anything.
Isn't it always like torn up jeans, sandals? You know, everybody's got sandals on in all these different countries.
I don't know. Maybe we're doing it wrong here.
Yeah,
in America.
I think so.
But when you are over there. How did they live over there as far as from how you grew up?
Well, same thing. I mean, you had it there too. I will say that the Iraqis that we were friendly with, you know, same thing. They're trying to make a living for their family. Very entrepreneurial. I'm pretty sure I must have had my fair share of cheap DVDs that I bought that were two-sided that I got two movies on. So like they To make, I mean, you know, beautiful country, good infrastructure, but, you know, a lot of things different. I think for me...
Was the national pride there with the Iraqis that you knew?
I think they were more relieved, but they wanted a better way.
Yeah.
That's how I kind of felt.
So somebody put it to me this way. You come to America and people have flag tattoos and, mm-hmm. and things of that nature. Somebody said you don't see that overseas in the Middle East.
No. But they still have pride, and I think that they're sharing some of the values that we have of just, you know, being free and being able to just express yourself how you want, being able to take care of your family. I mean, the economy, that's huge. And again,
that's an interesting perspective you just put forth there.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, some people didn't really like, they loved the country. They didn't like the administration.
Yeah.
If you know what I'm getting, you know, they were fed up with being told what to do all the time.
Yeah. Well, the freedoms that we enjoy and take for granted, they didn't have, especially under Saddam. They didn't have them.
You couldn't talk shit about Saddam. You couldn't go up there and say, listen, this guy is a total jerk off. He shouldn't be like,
but like
and
I said,
people don't think that things can happen to you if you do stuff like that.
The people that you were talking to, you said the ones that were friendly.
Yeah.
They were kind of like the anti-Saddam people.
Yeah. Most of them.
They didn't like the hierarchy.
No.
Is what I'm saying.
Like, well, you can't go up to a normal village Iraqi and go, hey, well, how about this asshole Saddam guy? Yeah.
No.
But talk to their military, and they were all about Saddam.
That's one of the things that I don't like that this country does, because they take that freedom for granted. Mm-hmm. Where they are leaders, they have that, and they don't understand that they have the freedom to say anything they want about any leader. And that's a freedom.
That's a good freedom. I think for many people that they grew up here, as opposed to people that have experienced like regimes all over the world that are oppressive, there's certain things that wouldn't be acceptable.
Right.
So you know, and again, look, we could be patriotic and still question the government. That's totally fine. I think that's the beauty about the system, and it's how you engage. However, you know, I think those people just wanted a better life. And listen, anytime something happens, there's a regime change, there'll be winners and losers. The problem is you have a lot more losers than winners. So, of course, the military was you know, loved Saddam. He was taking care of all of them. But the rest of the people, they're starving. You know, they're doing things that they don't want to be doing or have to make a living. You know, it's not good. Total opposite of what I saw in Kuwait, which Kuwait was like, wow. You know, I couldn't believe that but
what was different about Kuwait?
Kuwait was built that they're so affluent and rich.
They had all the oil money.
And they import people to work for them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then at one point,
America used to do that too. It didn't work out so good.
I know. But Kuwait was just like, it was like.
You had to go there, right?
It's I did. Crazy. Yeah. I did. When he said it, I'm like, I'm thinking about it. Yeah, we used to do that too. Yeah.
We got to, you know, change the strategy. But yeah, I was blown away because we provide all the security for that country. And everybody kind of, you know, so I'd be interested to see, you know, what other places like Dubai look like and all that stuff. But I was very surprised. Everybody's driving a Benz in Kuwait and really nice roads in the middle of a desert. I mean, it's like a sight to see, but people don't know how rich that country used to be. And I tell people all the time, if you go back in history, 91, if you would have bought the Kuwaiti dinar, it became the most valued currency in the world a couple years after that first Gulf War.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The Iraqi dinar, I tried my luck with that, but I'm still waiting.
So, I actually have a piece of Iraqi money with Saddam's face on it. I do. Somebody gave it to me. I can't remember who gave it to me. But you go through these deployments, and you see both the good and the bad, and not only your own military, but also in the indigenous people of that country. What are some of the things that you didn't like about the people you served with? Like, I'm not talking specifics, generalities.
Well, I mean, I think everybody, they reacted to the deployment differently. And that's what people have to understand. I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, I wouldn't admit it. I'm sure you guys won't admit it either. But, you know, listen, you go into an experience like that, everybody is scared or afraid or nervous or anxious.
Yeah, you're going to war.
That's just, you know, but people play it off like, no, yeah, you know, like I've done this before. Yeah, you know, this shouldn't be a problem. So I think everybody just had to adjust and adapt to that new reality. And everybody coped with it differently. Just like when we get back from that, people deal with the transition from that differently. And I think that that always gets misconstrued because, you know, veterans is not a one-size-fits-all population. Like, everybody has had their childhood, their trauma, their stuff that happened in their life. Then they join the military. Now, if you had issues before going in, you know, these issues might get worse. But it all depends on a lot of different factors. So I think that, you know, looking at it in hindsight, if I ever got upset with somebody or somebody was acting like an asshole, it's, you know, you always think, okay, what else is going on here that is causing somebody to act like that? And
that's a very mature mindset, because most of the world can't think like that.
Yeah. Well,
they'll start throwing fists before they start asking questions.
Well, yeah, everybody, you know, gets on Section 8. But back there, we had the Section 8 tents. There was eight of us in that tent. So we had to kind of get along. But you start to, when you're in that environment with somebody, I mean, you learn a lot of stuff. I mean, look, you had guys that were mid-career. They want to get back home to their families. You know, they got kids. That time, I had no idea what that was even like. I was a single guy. You know, the shit going on at home with the wife or the girlfriend. You know, you get a Dear John letter. So you got all this fucking drama going on, and you got to go out there and perform. And listen, it's not like, you know, you can take a break from it. I can't go to Iraq to go to downtown Baghdad and hang out and come back. It's not, you're in that the whole time. I
can't just say I'm going to the grocery store.
Listen, I'm going
to be back in a couple minutes.
You know, we had the Haji Mart, right? But I mean, that was right next to the base. So for me, it was just like 24/7. You're there. You're trying to survive. I think the way I could describe it is, for me, when I touched down there and when we had our first contact, I said to myself, okay, don't look forward to Christmas. Don't look forward to New Year's. Don't look forward to none of that shit. You have to try to get by day by day. And when that plane leaves this country, you're still going to pray to God to make sure that you can get there okay. But, you know, things happen. Like, I'll give you a story. We replaced the Florida National Guard, and they were training us. So there was an E6, Spanish fellow from Miami. He was teaching us the ropes, what to do and all that stuff. And he had one day left in country. One day, he was supposed to be on a plane the next day. He goes to the PX in Anaconda. They shoot a mortar round, fucking kill him. Sorry, guys. So then you try to make sense of it. You try to say, holy shit, like, how the...
Well, you can't spend your whole time over there walking on eggshells. You got to...
No, but think about think about the luck of that, right? And you say to yourself, man, you know, like, the things have gone different. So that's where you really don't waste too much time trying to make sense of it, and you just deal with it. Like, I think you just got to keep going forward and know, like, listen, if it's your time, it's your time. There's no way. You can only control what you have control over. But think about it. This guy was going to the PX's shop for stuff that he probably needed, and then he gets hit by a mortar round.
Yeah. Well, at what point did you say to yourself, obviously you came back home. At what point did you say the military's enough? Like, because I'm sure you had a choice of whether reenlisting or getting out. It's time to start your life. You had enough of this.
I think I lost a few friends out there, but I think the one that hit me hardest one when I lost my friend towards the end of the deployment, and it was stupid. It was because of rollover accident. Stuff happened in leadership. Things could have been done differently. Some people could have stood up and said, hey, you know, can't put my guys through this. We need a break. But he passes, and I know that when that happened, I probably shut down for like 2 days, like crying like a baby, you know, crying, like uncontrollably, like because I thought it was so senseless, right? That if somebody would just had the balls to say, listen, give our guys a...
So it wasn't being lost in battle.
It was lost because of an accident. Yeah. Lost because of an accident.
I was going to say rollover. So it probably rollover, just yeah. Well, rolled, went off so, the road and...
You're working 16, 18 hour days, right? Now, back then I was 24 and I was living off of Red Bulls just to stay up. I was a gunner, right? So you had to be alert, right? Yet, when you get out in that road, you had to be alert and you're stuck out there. So my friend, and this is the crazy story. My friend, great guy. When I came out, probably one of the best guys in the unit, served active duty, was serving National Guard. He used to talk to me every day about his son. His son just started his career and he went for the first deployment. And he used to tell me every drill weekend, man, I'm worried about my son. I said, don't worry, he's going to be all right. He's going to be all right. He comes back. The son comes back. He goes and for a bullshit rollover accident.
Wow.
That sucks.
You know, it's those, you go over there and it's more palatable to the people over here anyway. I can't speak for people overseas. When somebody dies in battle, when a soldier dies in battle, it's more palatable. But when they die in a training accident or an accident, it's
a risk, man. And here's the thing. Our unit, thank God, we didn't have any casualties. There was casualties around us. Other units, like the unit that took over for us, they got hit the first week. But we had a couple injuries, but no, we didn't lose anybody to battle. But rollover fucking accident.
You know, like you said, I mean— to be killed in action is one thing. To be killed in an accident, you know, like you said, roll over. And
that's rough.
Yeah, it's rough. And look at Pat Tillman, friendly fire.
Yeah. I mean, the thing.
That's crazy.
I think it was a Jets fan who did that. No, I'm sorry, Pat. Listen, he's one of my heroes. But most everybody over there is my hero.
I mean, you know me. I go to all the runs, I buy all the t-shirts. Pat Tillman is a true American hero.
But look what he gave up to serve. Exactly. And a lot of people are not going
to
do that. He
gave up a professional football career to go fight.
As a young man to go over there and serve because it was his duty, because he loved America, just the same way that you seem to have loved this country and found a purpose, the military. So from what you're telling me about the military, it made you grow up. But at some time... you're grown. You're as grown as you're going to get, and it's time to leave. When you separated from—
what's it saying? You're a grown-ass man?
You're a grown-ass man.
You're a grown-ass man now.
When you separate from the military, did it sort of leave you a little shiftless?
Well, I was very fortunate because when I went to Brooklyn College, I was fortunate enough to work for the Veteran Affairs and Counseling Center. And my boss was married to a Vietnam vet. So back then she knew way more than I did. And she used to tell like stupid stuff. Like when I got back, she said to me, listen, go talk to somebody. And I said to her, well, I mean, are you sure? Like, I'm fine. Like, no, I didn't know anything back then. And I fought her tooth and nail, but I went right. Just to get some things off my chest. But I think I was always fortunate to have like a good supportive environment. And just seeing veterans transition back to school, I always used to joke around and ask, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up, right? Because we're at that stage. But everybody has different different experiences, and they're at a different point in life with their military career. Like, they, you know, I get the guy who did their enlistment, they're done with it, they just want to move on. I get the 20-year guy who that's all they know, and they have to transition and have to figure out what to do. So I'm very grateful that I had the people that were put in my life to kind of guide me through it. So I never really had too long of a period where I thought that I wasn't, you know, serving or I had a purpose.
Well, you still, from what you're telling me that you're doing now, being involved in veteran services, although you left the military, you really never left the military.
No. Well, I enjoyed that camaraderie, because you can't get that. I mean, there's only a few professions where you can get that. And see, you can only understand it if you live through something like that. You know,
well, same thing with law enforcement.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah.
We left police work, but we never left police work.
Yeah, and I don't think that it becomes part of you.
Right.
As much as people, you know, want to try to, if you're a soldier, you're a soldier. You're a cop, you're a cop. That's in your core.
They can take you out of the military, but they can't take the military out of you.
Yeah. And I believe that with many people, when they transition, it's such a culture shock back to the civilian world. You're like, holy, what the hell is this? So
there's an alarming thing with the veteran community, and unfortunately it muddies the water for people who really need it. And this is something I kind of wanted to get in with you, but I didn't quite know how to approach it. It's, do some veterans take advantage of the system?
Absolutely.
All right. So what are some of the ways that they do? Because in my mind, if somebody is taking advantage of the systems or taking resources away from somebody who really, really needs it. So what are some of the ways that somebody coming home would take advantage?
Taking real advantage of the system. Now, there's a perspective that I can offer for that, right? Because if you look at the system as a whole, and knowing what I know, and knowing some of the things that money gets spent on, and I'm pretty sure your career, you've probably seen it in your departments or dealing with municipal government, right? My thing for veterans is, are you trying to improve, right? That's just my thing personally. But to be honest, taking advantage of the system has a lot to offer to veterans. Now, I'll give you an example, right? Like, we're always measuring our service, right? You know, person might not have any experience overseas, right? They might have done their tour, they get hurt, they get 100% disability for the rest of their life. Meanwhile, you got the guy who's missing two legs, an arm, and they're fighting the VA.
They're just gonna say three legs.
Yeah. But I've seen this happen, Mike. That's why it drives me nuts, because I'm like, who the hell was your service officer that did your claim? So to me, you know, just trying to make sense of why certain people don't get certain things.
Well, that's across the board.
Yeah, but
we've seen it in police work.
Yeah, you'll see it. And my thing is always, you know, trying to give everybody the best possible chance to get whatever they need. After you see what some of the dumb stuff that money gets spent on, right? If it could go and support a veteran and their family, I'm all for that, because again, the issue that a lot of people have, that a lot of veterans have, is that they don't think that they're messed up. They're just trying to function with all the stuff that happened. So taking advantage of somebody, like, I'll give you a perfect example. Like, for me, you know, one time I was in the office and a kid came, right? I knew there was some mental health issues, but the kid was young. So I'm talking to him about jobs and stuff like that. And he's, oh, what about this? What about that? What about this? And I'm like, but kid, you're like 25. Like, you don't want to find out about like GI Bill or something like that. Like, you want to go right to the, like, you know, you get that stuff if like you got nothing else going for you. Right. And you don't seem homeless. So, you know, talk to me, like, what's going on with that? Like, why do you feel that, you know, and again, everybody's situation is different. I think for me, some people's level of entitlement can be up here when it should be down here. You know, you're always trying to find that happy medium. But I mean, you could, you know, with your experience, you can tell like somebody that can really, really use it and there's no chance. And again, your goal should always try to be is to try to make anybody who you interact as productive as possible for society, if that's possible.
Well, what I was saying, we seen it in when we go through the retirement process. When group therapy, Mike and I were in there together, we've seen some guys come into group therapy where they've been in three shootings and they got everything. Like you'll say to ourselves, and you know who I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. You got it. Like, don't worry about it. Pension system's going to be pretty simple. It's actually going to be easier than most for you because of you see all the signs. And they get denied their pension. Where you have somebody on the other hand who
puts a staple through their finger.
Yeah, or has an ingrown toenail.
You see? That's the system.
That's the system. And you know, do we hold it against the person who worked the system and found the holes in the system and got what the system is providing? Or
do we hold it against the system itself?
Do we hold it against the system for not seeing somebody who truly, and I'm telling you, there's no bullshit on this one. This one guy that we're talking about, he had everything to to retire, with honor. But they denied him. He went and fought for it. But he had to fight tooth and nail and spend extra money that you don't have at that point in order to get what he should have gotten.
Because
no, but
you almost sorted me on a tangent.
I see it all the time. I see it all the time too in the veteran space, and some things just don't make sense. So I always try to be somebody who will try to get people to lean towards being productive. Now, if somebody like needs it, and there are people out there that need it, I'm not, we'll still do what we got to do, get them housing, get them all the stuff that they need. But everybody's situation is different. I'm curious to know, like, who's the administrator or the bureaucrat who looked at that and that made sense to them. Yeah. And that happens too. That happens a lot, unfortunately.
But you know what it is? Because you have people who haven't gone through that making the decisions.
Yeah.
Right. They haven't gone through what these veterans went through, and they're making decisions on behalf of that veteran, and they have no clue. Talk about mental health issues and stuff like that.
Well, here's another one that
they're making decisions based on something they had no clue.
Here's the other one that I'll throw there out there too. That could be true. You also have veterans that might not have the same level of service, and I think for me sometimes, And you got to really, work hard to earn a trust. So somebody starts off the bat, says, oh yeah, I'm a veteran. That's great.
You're in Hawaii during the war.
But that's what I'm saying. So a lot of people use that too, to earn the trust of the vet. Yep. And I always say, okay, well, that's good. That's a good thing. However, look at what that person has done and look at what that person, the outcome. Same thing when we do, we look at the nonprofits. If you want to get into that.
Before we get into that, because I want to touch on that. So veteran services, you're heavily involved. I want to point out something because my research has brought this up to me. When you were running veteran services, was it Bergen County?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For Bergen County, you had one of the greatest wins of any person working to advocate for veterans I've ever heard of, the 0% homeless. Mm-hmm. And you were a pivotal part in that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you explain that a little bit?
So just so that your audience knows, that doesn't mean that there's never going to be a homeless veteran ever again. Got a lot of slack for that. Oh my God. What that meant was that we were able to develop a system, county government system, that could respond to somebody that had veteran homelessness. So part of my background too, besides the education, I did real estate, which a lot of people don't know. So it was very easy for me to know where to look to find housing options. We had our shelter, who our shelter director, she was great. Ms. Julie Orlando, awesome, phenomenal to work with. We gave veterans preference in our shelter, right? So we had everything there. We had all the tools there to respond quickly to the issue and the problem. And we partner with enough people that if somebody became homeless, we can pretty much square them away depending on their situation. Now, again, everybody's situation was different, but just having that tool and knowing how to do that helped out. I think once we were done, about over 420 veterans and their families in safe, affordable housing.
If there's one thing a veteran, just give them a home base. That's why that struck me so deeply, because veterans should have a home base. Just, it doesn't have to be much.
No,
just
someplace
someplace to hang their hat.
But here's the interesting part. A lot of communities can do it if they want to. That's the thing. Now,
but then you take out all that nonprofit money.
Yeah.
And that gets us into your nonprofit.
Well, that's a great segue. Thank you.
you like so, that?
So, that's why we do this.
So our nonprofit, very simple.
What's it called first?
NJSOS Veteran Stakeholders. And it was founded through a gentleman who worked Catholic Charities, Mr. David Pearson, started the group in Patterson. And premise is very simple. It's just to bring everybody to the table that has something to offer.
Other nonprofits?
Other nonprofits. Listen, if you have something to offer veterans, we want to hear from you. I think if you want to just simplify it, think of it as networking for social services.
It's an interesting concept because there's a lot of different nonprofits out there specifically for veterans.
Yes.
Police world, I'm not throwing shade at the police world because we do the same thing. So there's nonprofits for veterans with blonde hair, veterans with brown hair. There's a nonprofit for every type of veteran out there. And I was always afraid that it really waters down the amount of resources that are available to vets because they kind of don't know. There's all these nonprofits out there, but you know everybody's trying to grab a piece of the pie for their own nonprofit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I read somewhere 9,600 nonprofits, veteran nonprofits in the country.
Holy cow.
Like 5 billion just nonprofits. That's not counting government, state, or municipal money.
People are twisting their heads saying, you know, which one's right?
The thing is,
they don't vet them like they should.
That's the whole point of the stakeholder. So, you know, so we vetted each other, right? Because we needed to know. Same concept applies. So if you come, right? And this used to happen all the time in the county. Oh, yeah, I know this politician, and we do all this stuff, this and that. All this BS, right? Prove to me that you could do something, right? Yeah. I'll give everybody a chance, but if I refer somebody to you and they have a bad experience, why am I going to go out here and say, oh, no, yeah, go to these guys. I'll take care of you. And here's the thing. The issue always with social services is that nobody has marketing or outreach budgets to do this stuff. So, you know, my job as the county director is, you know, I don't fall into like a delusion where a lot of these people get onto the job and they always complain that they don't have enough to make it happen, right? Cops always try to make a job happen with less. That's an army thing. Like, we never get the ideal situation. It's not going to happen, right?
Exactly.
So I can't come in here and say, yeah, you know, I don't have the tools to really solve this problem. So I had to develop partnerships, man. Like,
you got to figure out a workaround.
So people that were very political, their whole thing were like, well, you know, that's a lot of exposure for the county. I said, dude, listen, if you're doing the wrong thing, people are going to know. I would rather say, hey, I'm here. How can we work together? Than just stay in the office. What? People are just going to come to me? So stakeholders was like, okay, well, let's get to know and learn about what everybody's doing. And we tell people, like, listen, you know, people do the spiel, homelessness, employment, this, that. Okay, what do you do well? If I go to you right now, what can you do for this veteran? Oh, you're an SSVF program. Great. So you have funding that can help low-income veterans if they ever become homeless or they need rapid housing. Wonderful. What do you do? Oh, we do claims. Great. What's your success rate with claims? Because if you charge a vet, that's fine. You got to disclose that. I'm more interested in, like, you know, do you treat the veteran well and is it a good value for them? The free VSOs, right? You could do it for free too. Are they any good? Like, what I would recommend it to the state if I know, like, because anybody can just say they put in a claim, but what's the outcome after that? So that was the whole point of stakeholders, is just knowing and sharing and listen, being serviceable. Because, you know, I always put it to you this way. When I started, and they were building a housing complex in Woodridge, affordable housing, 110 units. I go there, right? Knock on the trailer, right? Like a jerk off, right? And I introduce myself. First thing the lady says to me is like, wait a minute, you're from the county government? I said, yeah, I work in Hackensack. What do you guys got going on here, right? And I explain myself, right? And having to give the gab is good because you could talk to people, but you say, listen, I like to know more, right? Found out that that person also worked with another person that I took care of at the school at FDU. They were dating at the time. So she calls me and she says, hey, we have these extremely low income units. We can't get them filled. You think you can help out with that? I'm like, absolutely.
Tomorrow.
What do you need? She goes, well, can you get, I said, no. I'll send you something. What do you need? How much is the rent? Like $285 a month. Furnished one bedroom.
They got anything left?
Yeah.
Always looking for those deals. But here's the whole point. The property manager was just happy that like somebody went and talked to her. But how does that word get out? So we're always constantly looking for that stuff.
The affordable housing is big in New Jersey. And I'll give everybody a window because it's something I kind of work with now. The affordable housing, it's not what everybody thinks it is. They see these big high rises going up, or they see a whole development going up and there's 500 units.
Mm-hmm.
And it's under COA, affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the reality of it. Only 20% has to be earmarked for affordable housing.
Yes, correct. And if the town may or may not have already met his obligation.
Right. So at 20%, say there's 500 units, so there's 100 units that are going to have affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the developer is going to be able to sell those other 400 units at full price or above mm-hmm. market value. Here's the thing with COA. Years ago in the 70s, the developers somehow convinced the politicians
to pass
this COA law and the developers. And guess who's getting rich? It's the developers. It's unfortunate because there's enough people in this state that truly are in need of affordable housing. But think about it from a political standpoint. If you're a politician, are you going to vote against affordable housing? What, you don't like poor people? What's the matter? It's optics.
Yeah, it's always optics, but the issue too also becomes that the politicians or the elected officials at that time, they're not thinking 20, 30 years ahead either. So one of the big things, you know, getting over here and driving in that Route 4 traffic on Jesus Christ, you're pulling your hair out, but you see the development. Now, you know, towns always have an obligation to protect their communities, all for that. And there's certain things that you can do to mitigate that. But veteran housing seems to be like the sexy thing for politicians because who's going to say no to veterans?
Who's going to say no to veterans?
Yeah. But there's certain things that you can do that or there's certain ways you can manage it to kind of mitigate any type of risk. I know Emerson, when that was done, 2017, we did a whole big thing, 14 units, Housing Authority of Bergen County did that. And we got a lot of our stakeholder partners to do donations.
Are they officially rich kids if they get housed in Bergen County?
Well,
north of Route 4.
Okay.
Yeah, north of Route 4.
All right.
Below Route 4, you're still struggling. Up Route 4, you're fine. But same thing. Like, you have them in all the communities. Like, I'll give you an example of somebody I thought really did it well. And this is where, again, goes to the whole government thing. You think Section 8, you're like, oh, man, you know, crappy housing authority, NYCHA. You think all that crap, right? Go to Cliffside Park and see how they run their housing authority. Same funding, same thing, but two buildings, veteran preference.
So it's all about the management is what you're talking
about.
It's
part of it, yes. Yeah. But none of this, like, because here's the thing that I found out too, right? Doing this work, you know, Bergen County is the biggest county in the state population-wise. And we have 70 municipalities, which I'm still trying to learn. But, you know, people in Newark or people in Jersey City, the governments that run, they're like, oh, man, but you guys got no problems up in Bergen County. I'm like, dude, I'll take it to Route 46. We'll go find some homeless people. Like, they're out everywhere. But how things are managed are different. And again, Cliffside Park, okay, urban, however you want to classify it. It's close to the bridge, 20,000 residents. But the mayor was a World War II veteran. His son's there now. I like the way that they run their housing authority, just their housing authority, because you have buildings, you have a senior center, which is important. You need things to do. And you got veteran preference, which many communities could do if they choose to.
And they have transportation in Cliffside too.
Yes. Yep.
So give out your nonprofit again.
NJSOS Veteran Stakeholders.
You got a website? What's
NJSOSvets.org. Still working on that, but we also have a Facebook group, and the email is NJSOSvets@gmail.com.
Beautiful. You got any other plugs you want to throw out?
Catholic Charities, Archdiocese of Patterson, SSVF program, wonderful program. If you look it up, they have three clothing closets for vets that need stuff. They do a tank pull in Clifton every year, which is fun. So if you're stressed out in the office, and you want to take your rage out on an 80,000 pound tank, please join us. I'll be pulling on that day too.
Sounds great.
I'd love to do that. We have a plane pull for special. We never did tank pull.
Yeah, that might
be pretty cool. You got to come.
We might get a suffering podcast team out there.
We can do that.
Yeah, okay. That'd be
we have enough people.
Yeah. We'll get Andrew. He'll be able to cheer us on. I try to end this show in the same way every time. From going into the military, from your parents being first generation immigrants.
That was easy for you to say.
Yeah, right. And you growing up in Brooklyn, joining the military, doing your service, going overseas, to now seeing the second portion of the veteran life and really trying your best to help out those veterans. What do you think that suffering of veteran services has taught you?
Not to give up. And if anything, this is what I always say to myself, no matter how bad it gets, the storm is always going to pass. So I think if you're in it to really help people and empower them, you have to have the mentality that it's going to get better for them. If you lose that, then the work can become very burdensome. But, you know, I always like to spin stuff. So whatever negative you give me, I'm going to try to turn into a positive.
See, I like
that. It's a great idea to have, a great attitude to have, I should say.
I really like that. AJ, thank you so much for coming in and joining us tonight. I appreciate it. I love what you're doing. I love hearing the updates from your buddy Mike. I appreciate Mike Martin very much for hooking us up. And listen, we're going to talk after the show.
Awesome.
Let's see what we can do.
I really appreciate what you're doing for the veterans. I mean, that is fantastic work. It really is.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast, The Suffering of Veteran Services with AJ Luna. And let's think about all the stuff that we learned. Always improve your position. Perspective makes you appreciate. There are those that run towards, and there are those that run away. Resources are vast, but often hard to find. But most importantly, don't give up. The storm's going to pass. That's going to do it for this episode. Go to popple.com for a digital business card. Put in the code TSP20 for a 20% discount. Follow us on all social media. That's TikTok, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram.
OnlyFans.
There you
only
go. Follow Mike.
I said fans only again. I don't even know.
Follow Mike at Mike_Fillets. Follow me at Real Kevin Donaldson. And of course, follow the Suffering Podcast. And we'll see you on the next episode.